the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. I'm Aaron Flores, and I owe Lisa another dinner.
And I'm Lisa Nims, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We're the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering bicycling, train and transit, and simpler living. And today, battle bikes.
That's right. We have James Longhurst here. He's going to teach us how to build bikes for battle. He's like shaking his head. No, he has written a book called Bike Battles. The subtitle of that is A History of Sharing the American Road. And he will also be speaking at the Oregon Historical Society tomorrow at noon. Tomorrow being the 23rd of June. And at the Garden Home Community Library also at 7. So if you're lucky enough to get this in time, head there. And also in the studio with us is Will Vanley.
Hey there.
How's it going?
Oh, pretty good.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lisa, you're back in Portland.
I am. How's Hello.
It? Yeah. How was your time away?
It was good. Yeah. I lived in a teeny tiny mountain town down in California called Placerville.
Oh.
It's in the heart of gold country. It's known as Old Hangtown. So,
oh. Hangtown.
So I lived right off of Main Street, and on Main Street they still have where the hangman's tree was. They have a mannequin hanging from a noose. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's got a dark
history. Country town.
It's got a pretty dark history, and they're just embracing it, and it's great. It's great.
I don't know what to think about that.
It's very strange.
You came back.
And I'm back. No, it was really great. Super interesting. And I made friends. It's a really big mountain biking community out there.
I was wondering what they put on their brochures for the town.
Right?
It was just like a picture of the tree. Or if there was something else that this place had to offer.
No, they're...
Come to Old Hangtown. See the tree.
They're big into mountain bikes out there. There are not too many people who are riding road bikes. I think I met all of them. They were like... 6 or 7 of us. So, yeah. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
And you came back for what reason?
I started grad school today.
Oh,
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm getting my master's of social work and a certificate in gerontology. So working with old folks.
Yeah. Which if anybody remembers the last time you were on, that was one of the things
the
that we talked about.
The first time.
Yeah, it wasn't the last time you were on.
That this year for Bike Fun, I was going to try to organize a...
Arthritis ride. Yeah.
I have not...
And that's pretty cool.
Right?
Yeah.
I haven't made the progress yet, but...
You should do it.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of, you know, finding a route, really.
Yeah. And organizing a bunch of folks.
Well, you just put the word out there and see who shows up.
Yeah.
It could be nobody.
Could just be me.
Last weekend, I was on a Pedalpalooza ride of 3 people.
Oh.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. It was the Sweet Pea bike ride.
Yeah.
So it was for Sweet Pea owners. For those of you who don't know, Sweet Pea Bicycles is a women's-oriented frame builder. And also she is one half of the podcast Snack Parade, which I produce. And so I felt some loyalty to go there. And it just happened to be the 3 of us who are in Snack Parade showing up.
Oh, that's pretty fun.
Yeah. And it was
good
cool.
Thing you showed up. Yeah.
Or it would have just been those 2.
Yeah. Yeah,
I wish you had told me about that because, you know, as a Snack Parade fangirl.
That's true.
I would have been there.
Yeah, it does actually sound like a very good time. I just don't have a Sweet Pea, but, you know, it would have been
fun
anyway.
I didn't either.
Oh. Nice.
I've got a Surly.
Nice.
It's probably about as opposite of a Sweet Pea as you could get.
Yeah.
Yeah. How you been, Will?
Oh, I've been good. Speaking of Pedalpalooza rides, we bumped into each other on the disaster ride other day. That was a lot of fun. And
the ride that like toured every building that's going to fall apart.
Yeah, and I learned that the big red U's on the buildings in downtown mean it's unsafe. It's not up to fire code. So it's up to building code, but it's not up to fire code.
Yeah,
so
I had no idea what that meant.
Don't go in there. Yeah, now I know. I used to work in one of those buildings, so and I just found that out years later. So it's fantastic. But yeah, and ran right out to the store and bought a bunch of water containers afterwards for the big earthquake. So
there you go.
Was super excited to fill up a shopping cart full of 7-gallon containers, like cleaned out the Bi-Mart. And yeah, they thought we were a little weird, but you know, we'll be set now.
That's right.
You know, when the earthquake comes.
Yeah.
We'll see who has the last laugh cashier.
Oh yeah, for sure. She's going to be knocking on my door wanting some water when the earthquake comes.
You laughed at me at the Bi-Mart. No.
Yeah. Now who has the water? No, it'll be real good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and speaking of water, I feel like I should update every one of my rain barrels since that's what I came on the show to talk about last war. Actually, I bought a solar panel and some equipment to start a little off-grid pump and some things to actually get like a pressured water system running off my rain catchment. So that's coming, and I'm going to try not to electrocute myself, and we're going to see how this goes.
You said off-grid, so you're putting a generator on it? Or?
No, it's just a solar panel and a couple car batteries and a little charge controller. So
power is going to be enough?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, the panel's about like 3.5 feet by about 5 feet. So it's, you know, it's not a tiny panel, but it'll charge 4 car batteries pretty reliably, even in Oregon. So
awesome.
That's the idea, at least, and the shaky math that I've been doing on the internet. So, yeah, we'll see. Remains to be seen.
Well, yeah.
I'll come back another time and let you know whether or not I've electrocuted myself. So it'll be good. Water and electricity, what can go wrong?
I'm feeling like we would know.
Just sparks coming in from near the Brooklyn train yard, and you know.
The power just goes out just for like half a second and comes back on.
Yeah, the whole city, I'm sure.
There goes Will.
Yeah. Oh, I hope not. We'll see.
No. Sorry. It's all jokes. Speaking of Pedalpalooza. 5 minutes ago, speaking of Pedalpalooza.
Oh, yeah. Bringing it back around.
Yeah. I wanted to share my experience with the Solstice ride, which was amazing. The first time I heard about it was 4 years ago, maybe, and I've yet to have gone on it. Just circumstances worked against me, and went on it this year. And, yeah, kind of lived up to, like, at least the fantasy I had built up in my head.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. And there's a little part of me that I went with a bunch of friends, and there's a little part of me that's kind of proud that I was the only one in my circle of friends that stuck through the whole way.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. Nice. Good work.
Yeah. And like not to like belittle them or anything, but just kind of like, yeah, I did it.
Yeah. Not everyone can make it to the end of the Pedalpalooza ride.
No.
Yeah.
No. Well, it is only a hearty few. That was... Oh, what did I say? 9 hours?
Yeah.
Yeah, so from 9 to 6 a.m.
Wow.
We were riding. It wasn't completely nonstop. There was, like, beer stops and just stops to, like, kind of rest your legs.
Was it just the three of you from Snack Parade at the end of that one again, too?
Or was little by little, they all dropped out.
Except the three of you hardy folks.
And then Natalie, Leah, and I we went out for tamales again.
Yeah, how many people were on that ride?
It started, I would say, with close to 50.
Mm-hmm. And then by the end?
12 to 15. Hmm. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's actually really good for an all-night ride.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was really cool. At one point, we stopped at this reservoir, and like everyone just hung out, and the ride leader was like, we're going to be here for at least an hour. We're way ahead of schedule. He apparently was thinking it was going to be 4 o'clock when we arrived there, and it was like 2:30.
Oh, wow. Way ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so like I took a nap.
Oh, nice. Oh,
perfect.
I unwrapped my scarf, and like it comes out to like a pretty big square, and like curled underneath it, and put a hat on.
That's great.
Slept on the ground next to my bike.
I might have come if I had known there were going to be naps in the middle. That's really nice. Yeah.
Hopefully next year. Like.
Yeah.
Now with more naps.
Yeah.
So James. Jim. Sorry. Yes. James is like your official name.
My mother and the IRS calls me James. but it's, you know, it's also my professional name. So, okay. All right. I'm going to go ahead and introduce myself
Please. In
a couple of ways, and I think the first one is, what kind of cyclist am I? Because that's what people can identify with. So what's my bike tribe? And I started as a triathlete, and then I decided that was stupid. And I became sort of a roadie and much more a commuting cyclist and then everyday cyclist. And I'm a local bicycle advocate in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And in the middle of all of this, and this all started about 2005, and in the middle of all this, I'm professionally a historian. I'm a historian of urban and environmental policy. I teach at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, and I've been writing in environmental politics for quite some time. And environmental politics is really depressing at a certain point, you know. And so I had finished my first major book project and about 2008, and I was looking for another project. And I was particularly looking for something that I could talk about the things I care about, which is how we make decisions in cities that make them either livable or less livable. You know, how do we make sustainable cities as democracies? And the problem with that was my first book had put everybody to sleep. And I was looking for something that I really wanted to do. I really wanted – and the bicycle became for me the vehicle to tell the story about how we make decisions that shape our lives as people who live in cities. So this is the book. It's Bike Battles, A History of Sharing the American Road, University of Washington Press, out now.
Yeah, it was really an interesting read, and I think it's not always easy to make transportation policy interesting. I liked the alternate title that you had for the book at the end, which was Selected Cycling Policy Debates. So you decided that was not what you wanted to go with in the end. But.
Yeah, my editor was like, no,
yeah.
No. You know, but that's, you know, and this is one of the problems is that people look at the title Bike Battles and they want to talk about the metaphor of cars versus bikes or a war on cars. Or whatever you want to do that, and that's not what I want to talk about
no,
at all.
No.
I want to talk about bike battles as periodic public decisions that we make about how we live.
Okay, mm-hmm. It's interesting how the phrase "war on cars" is like almost universal when it comes to the relationship between automobile and bike, and it's almost as if the bicycle is the perpetrator of violence upon a car.
Yeah.
And it,
talk about blaming the victim.
Right. Yeah. But in the meantime, like in the first chapter of your book, it talks a lot about how the bike is also kind of being blamed as the perpetrator of violence upon like the horse and buggy and
yeah.
And pedestrian.
And pedestrian traffic as well.
Yeah. The bike versus horse debates of the 1800s were pretty pretty entertaining to read about. Well, the dude whipping the people as he was riding along.
Farmer Absalom. Yeah. I still don't know if that's made up, if that journalist made up that story as a parable or if it really happened. I have no idea, but it's too good to leave out.
Yeah, yeah.
The, you know, one of the questions I have of this, and so, you know, we're all looking at the 21st century bike boom. We're looking at cities are changing somehow. We don't know to what extent. We don't know exactly what the cause or where it's going to end. And my question is, you know, what can history add to this? And there's one thing that history can always add, which is, oh, we've done this before. But that's not helpful,
no.
You know?
No.
And one of the things that's really not helpful is when history comes along and says, you know, bikes were here before cars. Because we know that as bikers, and we've known that for a long time. I guess maybe the broad culture doesn't know that, but... What else can we do after that? What else can we say beyond we've had these kind of discussions before? And I wanted to explore that in the book.
Yeah, and the point of the road being a public commons, I think, is a really good way, as you say, to approach it. You know, and that does, you know, as we get into weirder things like self-driving cars, that'll be, you know, because we're going to have to figure that one out eventually here, too. So
pretty soon. Yeah.
Pretty very, very soon.
Yeah. They're already driving those out on the road, are they not? Like in public?
Yeah.
Like in San Francisco?
Oh, really?
I think so. They're out in the wild, you know.
Under very limited licenses, and one of the clear things is the courts are unclear about who's going to be liable, you know, once those come under. And, you know, when I think of these as legal problems, and, you know, the question of when those go out of the hands of Google, you know, when a Google self-driving car runs over somebody, the lawyers know who to sue. when you buy a Google self-driving car and it runs over somebody, do you get... Are you liable? Is Google liable? Does Google license the software to somebody in Ford? Is Ford liable? You know, is somebody who's not maintaining the road? You know, and so that's when things are going to get really confusing.
Yeah.
More confusing. How about that?
Yeah, and it started to somewhat with surrounding some software controlling airbags and accelerators and things, I think, in some cars. Like, there's been some question as to whether or not software was to blame and how cars are managed already, so... Well, anyway.
One of the strange things...
Really an exciting topic that's a lot of fun to talk about, I can tell.
Apparently.
But, yeah, anyway.
One of the strange things that I saw happen just in the last couple of weeks is Uber raided Carnegie Mellon. You know, Carnegie Mellon is a robotics institution and in Pittsburgh, and Uber went to Pittsburgh and just plunked down a huge pot of money and hired, like, an entire robotics department out of academia.
Really?
And said, and so, you know, there's a couple of major forces that are working in self-driving cars right now, and one of them's Uber, and Uber is a very disruptive technology force, and we don't quite know what it is they're going to do. So if they're going to be changing the way that people get around...
Right.
We're really going to be looking at a very different road very soon.
Yeah. I mean, if there's a Google robot on the other end of that Uber app that you're using to call to get a ride, that's a pretty weird future to be in.
But we're going to live in the future so soon.
I know.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we're just like a month away, I think, from the year that Marty McFly went to in Back to the Future, I think, for real this time, according to the internet. So,
correct.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, that's a pretty big deal. We got to get the flying car thing.
Coke bottle or Pepsi bottle.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah. They got
hoverboard.
It. You got to believe.
And
yeah.
Hoverboard? Yeah. Mattel hoverboards, mind you.
Yeah.
So in writing the book, you know, I'm coming at this from... an outsider. I'm a cyclist, but I'm not, like, you know, like you said, I'm not a transportation engineer. Mm-hmm. And I'm not holding myself out as an expert in cycling. I'm not even LCI certified. And this is one of the things that come up. So when Seattle Weekly wrote their review of the book, it was a good review. But they also, you know, authors have very thin skin. And they said, well, you know, Longhurst admits to being a cautious commuter. And I was like, snippy, snippy, snippy.
Yeah.
But somehow takes away from your experience.
Well, but the thing was, you know, so if I have my advocate hat on, I want to talk about cycling being safe. And I want to say to people, here is where you should ride your bike and you will feel safe at the intersections and you can, you know, do these things. But if I have on my social observer historian's hat, I will also want to say it doesn't matter how much you get trained as a cyclist. The road is a strange place, and people disagree about where our places are in that. So,
well, yeah, and there could be any amount of laws to protect one as a cyclist, but if the culture doesn't observe said laws, or if the laws aren't enforced, it doesn't really matter, like, how safe or how skilled of a cyclist you are. Like, you don't belong on those roads, effectively.
The New York City has a law. E-bikes are illegal. E-bikes are not.
No kidding.
Do you know how many e-bikes exist in New York City? You know, every Chinese restaurant delivery man has an e-bike. Everybody.
Yeah.
And those are not allowed by New York City law. And it's a completely unenforced, you know, so it's both, you know, bright areas of law, and also the road is a commons that we negotiate constantly. When we come up to every intersection, we're figuring out, you know, well, the law gives me the right of way, but that guy's in an enormous SUV, and I know he's not going to stop.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like a negotiation. Mm-hmm. Engineering, politics, law, Newtonian physics.
So in researching the book, you said you kind of came to it as an outsider to bicycle culture, I guess. And so what was the most surprising sort of, contradiction either between laws or seeming between like culture maybe that you weren't expecting that you came across?
There's a whole list. I think one of them is going to be about me as an academic historian. And you know, I've been an environmental historian. That's my dissertation. That's the work I've done. And I assumed, I said, "Oh, I'm gonna start researching bikes." Mm-hmm. Somebody has to have done this from the environmental perspective. And I was really surprised at how little happened. And I want to say that there's some really good history. I love David Herlihy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of enthusiast history that's really enjoyable. People who work at universities and write textbooks and they publish in academic journals, most of them have not taken the bicycle seriously. And some of them, you know, the people in technology history have, people in gender history have a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the people in my little subfields, environmental history and urban history, people who write about the city and people who write about human relations with the environment, haven't written about the bicycle. And I couldn't, and I kept on looking over my shoulder. I was like, there must be somebody who's done this. And then I kept on coming up with these little untold stories, you know, forgotten history. So it's the 1890s side path movement. This fact that we know quite a bit about this big 1890s bike boom. You know, people are riding a safety bike. It's not the big wheel, and it's a fad. It's a popular high class fad. And I started doing some research. I was thinking, well, what new story could I tell about this? And I found this movement to create a separated bicycle specific network of paths alongside roads, different from sidewalks, different from the unpaved, unengineered roads. It was the side path movement. Upstate New York, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Chicago, lots of places were building these, and it was sort of not longer than about 5 years. But, you know, Rochester, New York built 200 miles of networked roads. St. Paul, Minneapolis, they kept some of theirs. didn't keep the name side path, but they maintained some of that through the 20th century.
Huh.
And the rest of America has forgotten about those because they were paved over in the Good Roads Movement, which came just after.
Yeah. And that's sort of the hanging question is like, so what happened? And so the Good Roads Movement came and...
And that was a great success. You know, cyclists were supporters of the Good Roads Movement, which was not just a movement to build roads, but a movement to convince people to pay for them out of general taxes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's a political non-starter of the 19th century. People don't pay for the general welfare out of taxation. And it took quite some time for the public schools to be funded, you know, rather than just funded out of the people who live right next to them. And 19th century roads are engineered or paved by the assessment on the people who live on them, not from taxing everyone. And so talking Americans into taxing everyone for what seems like the benefit of the few, you might never see that road that you are paying a tiny increment of taxation. That sounds a terrible imposition for the 19th century. The Good Roads Movement takes some time, and eventually the early support from the cyclists has to be sort of erased because the cyclists are not very popular. And so what began as the League of American Wheelmen, they publish one magazine. It's the League of American Wheelmen's Bulletin and Good Roads Magazine. They split that in two, and Good Roads Magazine becomes the product of civil engineers and road engineers. And we sort of forget the fact that the cyclist helped pave that. The cyclists really like the good roads when they come along because they're like, really, oh, these are great paved, engineered roads with no cars on them. And so they think they've won.
Right.
You know? And I think you said the word irony. One of the strangest things I think about is the fact that, you know, I go back to Rochester, New York, and I talk about the side paths there, and people have literally accused me of lying because they say, This has been erased.
So unknown.
The word is just, and they've accused me of lying to make up stuff to support bike advocacy. But the strangest thing to imagine is the fact those side paths are physically still there. They've just been paved over.
Yeah, they're just underneath the asphalt, right? Yeah. Yeah.
So there's several other ironies. I think World War II is a very strange story that you think that people are taking to the bicycle for very good strategic resource reasons, and you'd think that that might be of benefit to the bicycle over time. But I also think that the deeper digging I've done here shows that the rationing program known as the Victory Bike Program also cripples the American bicycle industry and associates adult bicycling with sacrifice. which Americans after the war.
Oh yeah,
they don't want to do.
This makes sense, right?
They don't want to do. They want the.
We
payoff.
Won the war. We got.
We survived the Great Depression.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And then won the war, and we want the things that have been denied to us, which include the freedom of movement of whenever we want to, at whatever speed we want to.
A car in every garage.
Yeah. A car in every garage. Yeah. And the sacrifice of riding your bicycle as an adult during the war is something you want to put behind you now. So, and in the 1950s, cycling becomes, again, but even more strongly, a thing that children do.
Right. Yeah, and it doesn't really come back. I mean, it's interesting because I think about today with the movement for trying to save the climate and everything, and how bicycling, I don't often as I would expect, see bicycling and bicycling for transportation brought up as a way to save the climate. And I wonder if it's because some like bicycle manufacturers don't want to associate themselves with some like such a negative, like, oh, by the way, the world's going to end sort of message, you know, because it would position the bicycle, the thing they're trying to sell, as like something of, you know, something involved in a sacrifice you're making.
That's an interesting point. I think only fat bike manufacturers could get away with that.
Yeah. they
this when the world ends.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It's a niche market.
I was kind of thinking of that today in another context. I was thinking about, you know, who makes up it, bicycle advocacy groups. And so you get, in my experience, in my niche of bicycle advocacy, I end up working a lot with destination tourism groups. Hmm. And so you get health advocates. You get, like, you know, health and wellness and hospitals and health management. You get destination tourism. You get some business buy-in, sometimes sort of city boosterism. What you rarely get is environmental advocacy. And I work mm-hmm. with environmental advocates in other components of my life, and it's not, I really don't think I've spent time working with Sierra Club or other conservationist groups, or, you know, it those two worlds somehow don't meet. I don't know.
That's interesting, because they would really benefit from each other, it seems like.
It might just, I don't want to say that that's national. And, you know, my expertise on this stuff as a historian, I stopped being useful about 1980. and so I am not an expert in exactly what's happening in advocacy now. So someone else's experience might be different.
Very cool.
I can talk more. What would you guys like to talk about?
Well, let's talk about, because you're currently doing a kind of bike tour.
Yes. Oh, where I can.
Yeah, where are you headed next?
So after Portland, I'm going to go home and collapse for a while.
Because sounds lovely.
This stuff is exhausting. It really is. And the logistics of it kill me. You know, historians, I really prefer not interacting with human beings. You know, going to an archive.
Right.
And it's very,
give me my library.
It's very quiet. It is often air conditioned. And it's wonderful. I like it.
And you're out on the road in the summer.
Right.
And,
perfect. So this is very tiring. So this leg of the tour, and then I go home, and then I'm going to ride to Madison September 1 and Milwaukee just after that. And that's I ride across Wisconsin. There's trails that are connect across the state, and that's a lot of
fun.
I've
heard it's beautiful. Yeah, I have some friends from Wisconsin that rave about it.
Particularly if you could go to bicyclelacrosse.com, which is my advocacy organization in town. We're working on destination tourism, and it's no kidding, world-class road cycling, and then a small college town that's really easy to bicycle around. So we do a lot of social rides and tour rides and ice cream rides and stuff over the 4-day bike festival over Labor Day weekend. So I'll do Madison, Milwaukee, and I'm going to do those by bike, and then I got to hustle back for the Labor Day bike festival, and then it's Los Angeles in November, early November, and Davis, California, right after that.
Wow.
So, and then I'll go home and collapse again.
Yeah. Right. So, that was the best part of the trip.
And you mentioned, like, at one point you had to get on the Amtrak, and you use their wonderful roll-on service. Amtrak's really easy, but like, you came out here from Wisconsin, assuming, out west. You didn't ride that whole way.
No. No, I would be much much cooler person. But you know, it's all multimodal, and one of my favorite things to do is go to a different town and ride that town's traffic and that town's bike infrastructure as an outsider.
Intriguing.
And you know, I've ridden Minneapolis and Chicago and Seattle and Portland, all as, and Detroit, all as, and Washington, D.C. and Wilmington, Delaware, all as outsiders. I kind of think it's a litmus test that if somebody who doesn't know the way the road is designed can navigate it, then you've done it right.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
And I was about to say that Portland really is really good. But then I got a little lost. I was coming over here past the new transit bridge, which is not yet open.
Yeah.
And I did not follow the cues about where the traffic designer intended me as the cyclist to go. And it turned out there was a special crossing of the tracks just for cyclists. But I did not understand that that was for me.
It's a little bit of a mess down there. I think that there's some sort of fundraiser that's blocking part of a trail right now. And it's still partly closed. And
I accidentally rode through it a couple nights back.
Oh, the festival
they
thing
were, like,
they've got going on?
Yeah, they were setting it up.
Oh.
Hey,
yeah.
I don't know.
Bike trail, man.
Yeah, you're just in the road.
That's where Google told me to go.
Come on. Absolutely. Yeah.
But, what has been your most interesting leg of the tour so far, like going from what city to what city?
I think it might be about me as the observer, but I visit Washington, D.C. every year or every other year, either for research or for something else. And that place is changing so quickly. The bicycle culture is exploding so quickly. And it's a bicycle culture that's very much an everyday cyclist culture. They are not dressed in any special way. They are dressed for the office. They are dressed to get to the office. They are dressed, very simply. And the bike share system there is a mode of choice for people getting in between offices. And it's, in a lot of ways, I worry about bike share being divided between the people who are already in a city and serving tourists. And I was like, oh, Washington, D.C. is going to serve tourists. Yeah. That bike share is used by people who are getting around.
Yeah, I went there. I went to D.C. a couple years ago, and I saw the same thing. I thought it was going to be like in Amsterdam, where they have all the brightly colored bikes. It's always tourists. But yeah, this was folks just getting to and from work, even in the heat, in business attire, which was amazing to get people over that kind of weather hump that so many times it seems that people don't want to get over.
And D.C., I mean, that's their problem. When we talk about biking in Wisconsin, people talk about, oh, the winter, you're going to do all this, you're going to spend all this money.
I was doing my best not to say something of that effect.
Oh, well, we can bash Wisconsin. They'll not listen to this.
It's pretty soggy here, too. It's not like we got a lot to brag about. But
but that's the weather hump for D.C. is it's a
heat.
Swamp. And people were like, well, they're never going to bike because, and yet, and the other, I think the other transformation I'm seeing is Chicago is changing so quickly. The 606, so that's their new High Line. So, continuous linear park.
Yeah, I read about that.
They're very proud of it because it's twice the distance and half the cost of the New York City High Line.
Yeah.
And it is amazing to watch real estate developers and businesses fall all over themselves to get a piece of that, to get on that. And that's a really different way of orienting cities towards development that is not about the car. And I think that if you see money being made on something like that, you're going to see other places. The other thing about Chicago is, you know who uses the Divvy bikes? People. Just plain
everyday people.
It is the most. It is the most.
Not until Google gets their hands on them.
Ethnically, economically diverse usage of bicycling I've seen in a long time. Because
that's the Chicago's bike share you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's great.
It is really phenomenal, and it really breaks the white middle class 42-year-old bicyclist monolith. And I think if you have a generation or so of Chicagoans associating who uses a bicycle with everyone,
yeah,
that changes how we fund bicycling, how we, you know, create political and legal institutions around it.
So between D.C. and Chicago, which of their bike share systems, or I guess which of their networks for bicycling do you think breaks that down and gets closer to that, like showing people that perception that bicycling is for everyone? Is there one city that does it better than the other, in your opinion?
Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in their phase two, they're going to expand into neighborhoods that are going to really change that.
So you think it's just basically the reach, like the neighborhoods are accessing and things that they're doing, a wider reach than D.C.?
Yeah.
Cool.
To sort of balance this, I'll say I think that D.C. has better on-street bike lanes. I certainly think that Chicago's done a lot, and I've seen a lot. I've not seen everything, but I've seen a lot. Chicago also has some really complicated, busy traffic where you see bicycles on, you know, 4, 5, 6 lane behemoths, and I'm like,
yeah, downtown Chicago is a pretty crazy place for traffic for everybody.
Yeah, I would never drive there. Yeah.
There's no way.
I grew up in Southeast Michigan and have gone to Chicago several times in my adulthood, and I hated driving there. My first thing to do in Chicago is find a place to park the car for the rest of the day.
Right, and get on the metro.
Then, yep, use the metro.
Yeah. I don't even like being in taxis in Chicago. It scares me. Like, I don't even like riding in cars there. Anyway.
I like this game. What's the best city for... That's always a good
one. It's a fascinating conversation. Because, I mean, especially with bike share, I wonder about which... I've experienced a few myself, but since Portland doesn't have one yet, I'm kind of thinking... how is it going to impact when we eventually have it? What can we learn from other cities? Hopefully, maybe we can do things.
Is that in process here?
It's been in process for
a long time. We're supposed to get it years ago. It is coming in 2016.
Right. But one thing or another, like, happens. Yeah. And it's...
Yeah, I'm okay with it being in process for a long time because it is a really easy thing to get wrong.
Yeah.
And little tweaks in design of the system or of the bike or of the business case for setting it up. I really like Nice Ride Minnesota, and they really have an interesting business model. And they're about to go from a city to a statewide system, basically.
Nice. For bike share, really?
Yes.
Wow.
They're expanding and recreating themselves in smaller cities. And that's going to be, I think, the first in the nation to do that sort of deal.
Do you have any idea if you can use it from city to city then? Is it one system?
I'll have to ask.
Because that's what,
that would be really cool.
My car-to-go card works, whether I'm in D.C. or Portland. It would be fantastic if my bike share fob would work in whatever city I went to. That would be killer.
That might be the sort of thing that they're going to do.
I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that I can live in the future at some point.
The future's coming.
Let's talk a little bit about bike lanes, bike infrastructure, separated lanes versus shared road usage.
Can we talk about it in a historical context? Because a lot of my expertise is there.
Of course. Historically, it was, you talk about the roads as a commons. Mm-hmm. It's shared space. It's common usage. But there's a lot of push now for separate, either via, bike lanes or bollards or something separating the automobile traffic from the cycling traffic.
Well, let me start with talking about what I mean when I say commons. And when I start lecturing too long, please, could you throw something at me? Because I love to hear my own voice. So commons, right. So this comes from the fact that I'm an environmental historian, and I come to thinking about bicycles from that perspective. And if you talk to people who've been to college in the last 30 years and you say to them environment and commons, they think of the essay Tragedy of the Commons. And this is the idea, Gerhard, and it's widely read, and it's the idea that if you have a shared resource like a pasture or a stream or something, and everybody gets usage for it, that everyone will tend to use as much of it as they can because that's in their self-interest, and it will spoil it. And that's the tragedy. And since Garrett Hardin's essay, more people have been thinking about this, and they've said, well, yeah, but when there actually are common resources like a pasture or a forest or a fishery, over the course of thousands of years, human beings have designed really good, useful, traditional systems for sharing those. And the people that overuse get excluded from the village or shunned or, you know, in some sort of way they're controlled. And it's only in very recent upheaval in human history, because the 20th century has been very transformative. And I know it's because we're really close to it, but it's changed a lot of things. And so a lot of those traditional methods of sharing things have broken down. And the road is one of those things. The road is a commons. It's existed for hundreds and even thousands of years in legal protection. It is so let's imagine you own property. I'm pointing at you. And that's your property. And you fence it off. And you guys want to go across that property. And in human history, what has happened is the imposition of their road or their passage on your private property is allowed in law if and only if that road, that passage, allows for the free passage of everybody to go back and forth. Otherwise, it's an imposition. It's your private property. But the addition of thoroughfares, the ability to go back and forth, or the king's highway, the protected passage, or eventually, as we call it, the public road, that's a useful thing. And the road is also a commons because it can be overused. You know, it can be destroyed. You know, you could imagine a usage that would block other people's fair usage of it. And so governments regulate the usage, you know, and that happened long before the automobile. So that's a long lecture. Anyway, so the road is a commons. It's limited, but it's shared and it's useful. And in history, it was shared by lots and lots and lots of different users.
And you talk about it kind of being a little bit self-regulating as well.
Yeah, because if there are users that block other impose themselves on other usages, then those other people sort of gang up and say, "Oh, wait, you can't do that," you know. And so this happened with the addition of rail freight, rail lines through many American cities, and the railroads in the 19th century were quite powerful. You know, they drove investment. And everyone wanted them. Everyone wanted their, you know, that was the life or death of a city, is whether or not you had a railroad that went to it. And so the railroads were in the streets. The tracks were in the streets. And these powerful railroads, they still had their ability to run a train through a city and park it there. They had that limited by the cities, because the cities eventually said, no, you can't actually do that. You can't actually block off our entire city by parking a train in it. And you have to make your tracks passable by others. And so they began regulating this really powerful industry through action. So yeah, so we're getting back to the shared lanes, you know. So the road is a shared resource, and the automobile, when it was added to it, disrupted that quite a bit. The popularity of the automobile was so huge in the early 20th century that it overrode a lot of other uses. The bicycle was out; it wasn't cool. The fad had died.
You mentioned it became kind of relegated to the children in a way. It's a toy.
It's a toy. And also, you know, that first fad of the safety bike was also a fad, a fashion. And things go out of fashion. It was associated with high class. It was associated with high technology in the 1890s. And it was reported. It was over-reported. So it became identified with that decade, and as things do, it dropped out of fashion, and into the 20th century it was no longer cool.
Yeah, I was really fascinated by how quickly that happened, too. It was just a span of a few years. It sounded like it was up and down.
And to me, fashion is the only way I can explain that, because it's not about utility.
Something really quick. Yeah. Yeah.
It's about the pet rock. It's about it's about the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. For me, the bicycle has always been a key to accessibility, to inclusion. And it's really interesting. While I was aware of this, it was still really interesting to read like how almost exclusive the bike was at the very first, you know, what with the big wheelers, mm-hmm. The penny farthings or whatever, being cost prohibitive, you know, not everybody could have bought them, and then just skill prohibitive. And then when the safety bicycle came along, those coming down a little bit in price, but still like there was this push of like, you know, I think the title of chapter two is like the right people.
The right sort of people.
The right sort of people. Yeah.
And I might be guilty of overemphasizing that, because I think that a lot of people who've written history of that time period are doing so out of a desire to identify with those people and to say and to talk about the golden age of bicycling, to sort of celebrate it. Uh-huh. And that's also true. You know, people are riding bicycles in the 1890s because bicycles are fun. You know, there's a lot of freedom. There's a lot of liberation. And I wanted to sort of add some things to that. And I might be overemphasizing that a little bit in reaction to the fact that people have told a lot of really positive stories. And it's also true, and humans are very complex that way, that there are some very negative stories.
Sure.
And
history is complex that way.
Well, you know, you say that. But when I talk with people who have, in their personal identity, wrapped up a lot of themselves in identifying with and reenacting the bike boom, there's some discomfort in recognizing the sexism, exclusivity, and racism of the early cyclists and the early League of American Wheelmen. And I understand discomfort. You know, when you identify with a thing and you spend some time buying a high wheeler and waxing your mustache and reenacting, you know, you don't necessarily want to talk about that discomfort. But it's also true that the 1890s bike boom is occurring at the moment when America is becoming more thoroughly racialized and segregated than it had been. I mean, this is Plessy versus Ferguson. This is the reinstatement of the color line. This is de facto and de jure segregation in the North and the South in the 1890s. And the people who are riding bicycles are, in our modern parlance, dude bros. They are young men with disposable income who are looking to display that disposable income to also engage in acts of masculinity in public. And
some things never change, I guess.
Yeah, no.
Every time has its dude bros.
It is acceptable, high-class, homosocial behavior. So I don't know how else to call it. So
right on.
How do we get there from shared lanes?
Inclusivity.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
We still never really talked much about shared lanes, but
when we're talking about shared lanes, one of the things we want to talk about is the fact that lanes are created to control the car.
Okay.
Lanes don't exist in the 19th century. In 1910, lanes, painted lanes, do not exist. And if you look at turn of the century film of roads, they are what Rome looks like today. You know, if you've seen Rome traffic, you know, it's just weaving cars and mopeds and weed. You know, Americans look at that and their reaction is either mockery or fear. And yet that was the American road for quite some time. And the creation of lanes is a traffic control measure, and traffic control is the control of the automobile. So lanes are drawn to control cars. They're drawn the width of cars.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're not drawn in ways that meet. There are no additional bicycle lanes created.
Yeah.
So it's one of those cruel ironies that to control the car, the bicycle is seemingly forgotten. So we've gone through then the 20th century with occasional calls to create separated infrastructure for bicycles, and they're generally not heated. You know, in World War II, people were saying, well, maybe we should change the way we design roads. Mm-hmm. But World War II was actually comparatively short. It didn't last that long for Americans. And so, you know, while bicycling was increasing, there wasn't time to build new roads or to redesign roads. And it's not until the 1970s when the bike comes back that people start thinking about bike separated bike infrastructure at that time. And there's another movement, the bikeway movement, and there's support, but no money. So if you want to think of history differently, the bike lanes that we're building now, you know, we're redesigning cities with green lanes, protected bike lanes, painted bike lanes, bollards, whatever. Why didn't that happen in the 1970s?
That's a good question.
Was it just a question of, I don't want to say culture, but just mentality? Where I think still even today kind of stuck on a very automobile-centric mentality and an automobile-centric thought that, you know, when designing a road or city even, you know, we think like, well, where am I going to park? Where am I going to drive this? Like, that's automatic, at least to me. Like, that's just ingrained in my thinking, even though I don't even drive. It's just that's what I do. That's how the brain works.
And bicyclists talk about when you spend a lot of time riding your city on a bicycle, the geography of it changes in your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
And things that seem far away from each other in a car, when you think in a car, you realize, oh, that's 7.5 minutes away on
the
bike.
Yep. Yeah.
Or alternately, you know, that hill, you're like, oh, geez, I'm not climbing that. That might as well be Mars. So when you think about when you mentioned culture and sort of imagination, sure. I think that's true. But at the beginning of the 1970s, people had the idea, and they looked at the energy crisis. They looked at the return of adult bicycling. They looked at the return of or the introduction to America of the derailleur and the multi-speed, 10-speed bike. And they imagined this bikeway revolution. And lots of people had this idea, and it didn't happen. And my explanation is money and politics, that the federal government was devolving decision-making down to the state level, and states weren't buying it. They weren't interested. The federal government interested a little bit. Department of the Interior interested. And then politics, you know, you begin the 1970s and the bike is coming back and adults are riding, and there is no bicycle advocacy organization on the national level. The League of American Wheelmen is split. It's tiny little chapters. It hasn't been organized on a national level in a long time. When it starts reorganizing as a national group, they themselves are politically split into pro-infrastructure and anti-infrastructure groups.
No kidding.
Oh, yes. So that's actually, in that chapter, I've been a little careful to talk about that because we don't yet have the sources that historians like to look at. Historians like to look at primary documents in archives.
Sure.
And we don't yet have those for the 1970s. We have some, but not enough. The League of American Wheelmen, what comes back as a national organization, has a knockdown, drag-out fight about whether they will be for even bike lanes or against them. And so this divides cyclists. And as a result, there's no pressure to create bicycle infrastructure. In fact, what we get is the cheapest imaginable bicycle infrastructure. The bike infrastructure that survives the 70s. You guys want to guess?
Is it the bike lane?
I read it in the book. Cheaper than that. It's the bike route signs.
The bike route sign, which is the most meaningless.
I remember seeing those as a kid and being like, what the heck does that mean? This is a four-lane road with no bike lanes. Why would you want to ride here? But,
I kind of like, the newer version of the bike route signs, the bike route wayfinding signs that say, bike route, this takes you this way. Those are better.
Yeah.
But the bike route sign...
Don't tell you where you're
going.
It's
got an arrow or it just marks that thing.
The bike route sign is the cheapest imaginable outcome. And the fact that that's what comes out of the 1970s, I think of as a failure of bicycle advocacy. And I will have people that will argue about that with me.
There's a part of me that wants to be like, no, it's the automobile lobby, and they throw all the money into, the anti-bike stuff.
And it's not joking. They have money. But, I tend not to go to conspiracy theories unless they involved Richard Nixon.
I don't know. Did he ride a bike? He doesn't seem like much of a bike rider.
No, but Eisenhower did.
Oh, did he really?
Yes, he did.
Oh,
his,
wow. I wouldn't think he'd have the time.
Well, his heart physician was a huge... Paul Dudley White was his cardiologist. And Paul Dudley White was one of the very early 1950s, 1960s American proponents of adult bicycling. And he promoted... I don't think the photo made it into the book. I have this great photo of him leading a group ride in Homestead, Florida.
Oh, that would have been cool.
He built one of the first protected bikeways in America in Homestead, Florida.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's really fun. Now I'll have to go find that photo. If it's not in your book, it's got to be somewhere.
Oh, I have it. I have it on a smart device somewhere.
I want to go find Homestead, Florida now.
Yeah.
it's a good place. There's those kind of bikeways were recreational rather than transportational.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
it's less about connecting one place to another and more about like just you have a place where you can ride your bike.
Well, it's Florida, so it's a place where people can drive their golf carts.
So I had a question about the energy crisis in the 70s again. We talked about during World War II when bicycles got associated with a sense of rationing or sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Do you think that played any role in the 70s? So when the energy crisis came and then when it was over, was there any sort of that same feeling of like, well, the energy crisis is over now. I'm going to drive my car because I was cutting back. Do you think that played?
That's a good question. I think... we talk about the 80s as a decade of excess, but but also in the 80s, there's the great success of personal cardiovascular exercise. jogging is the hit of the late 70s.
Getting physical,
80s.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not certain that same backlash against self-sacrifice exists, but it certainly might. I have to think about that. Because wrapped up in that explanation would be understanding how Americans feel about environmentalism.
Yeah.
Does coming out of the 70s environmental crisis mean that the 80s is a decade of consumption sort of in defiance of that?
That's probably depends a lot on who you ask.
Yeah. Well, it depends on a lot on whether or not you give me another beer.
There you go.
Yeah.
I got enough for another.
I do want to say this is an excellent espresso stout.
I'm really glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah. No.
Are you going to have a chance to... So I grew up in Eugene, which you mentioned in your book. Mm-hmm. And have you been to Eugene and ridden a bike around there at all? Or are you going to get a chance?
I'm not on this trip.
Okay.
I went to college here at Linfield.
Oh, okay. Fantastic.
And so I spent time in the 90s in Eugene and in Portland.
Yeah.
And really not so much bicycling then. There was mountain biking.
Yeah. Well, the city of Eugene has actually done some really cool stuff with some separated bikeways and some trails around the river. It's really grown a lot in the last 10 years. It's a real fun place to ride if you ever get to check it out. And there's a lot of amazing breweries there.
I think you should set up an author talk for me down there.
I think they have a lot of bookstores, I'm sure.
All right. Come right out.
I was thinking, you have a bunch of books whenever you go to talk, right? Mm-hmm. You have, are those shipped to the place?
Logistics?
Yeah.
These are things I don't control.
You have a really big trailer.
You're asking if I sell the books myself. I don't sell the books myself, and I don't profit from them. Usually what happens is if it's a talk at a bookstore, they're selling them, and if it's a talk at a library... quite often friends of the library or a charity, you know, will have a number of books sold and they take the profit off of that. So I'm an academic. I don't make any money. The royalties off of a university. University presses are basically nonprofits that that agree to lose money in a charitable way. So it's,
that's a good way to live.
Yeah, yeah. So the public good. Whatever.
Oh, well, I think this is a good time to head into news.
All right.
Jim, would you like to hang out with us as
Absolutely.
We read them? All right.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike? I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. It circles around the city lights. Pedal just as fast as we can into the morning light. Pedal just as fast as we can into the daylight.
All right. I will read this first one and we can take turns from there. First off, introducing the McBike, McDonald's new bike-friendly takeout container. Do you dream... This is, by the way, this is from bicycling.com, and this was sent to us via Doug Robertson, one of our sustaining donors. He got a kick out of this and wanted us to feature this. Do you dream of a Big Mac and fries in the middle of a long ride? Now McDonald's is making it easier for cyclists in some countries to fuel up on fast food mid-ride. Check out the McBike, innovative takeout containers that let you carry fast food meals on your handlebars without sacrificing the precious contents of your burger, fries, or drink. If this package convinces a few people that their mealtime errands could easily be done or be conducted by bike, we are on board, says bicycling.com. Which... Yeah,
how many people are out there are like, well, now McDonald's is on board. Right, I'm going to get on my bike.
I was really like, I was kind of weirded out by this whole, like, reading the full thing. It's really not that long. But was really weirded out by, like, what is McDonald's trying to do here? Like, is there really, like, a biking demographic that they really feel they need to get a hold of here?
Or? Apparently.
Yeah.
Can you bike through their drive-thrus?
Well... In many states, it's still illegal to bike through a drive-through. I think it's a municipal law, but
is it legal here?
Through
it varies by. I know different restaurants do it. I mean, Burgerville definitely allows it explicitly.
Well,
they have a sign that says it's cool. I've done it. I got a milkshake. Yeah, on my bike.
I've had to knock on.
I live like 4 blocks from a Burgerville. Of course, I've been there on my bike. I like those milkshakes.
Well, they do it. They've introduced this all over the world. You know, the full article mentions Copenhagen. You know, having success with this, of course.
Okay. Yeah.
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 You know, I find this kind of challenging for myself to read because I have such a, for lack of a better term, a snobbish view of McDonald's, you know.
Sure.
And McDonald's and biking and drive through and carrying my McDonald's food on my handlebars just doesn't, there's something about it that just doesn't seem right. And yet in the meantime, what if this does really convince somebody? It seems like a long shot, but what if?
Well, and it hangs on your handlebars, though. Like, anybody who's riding their bike already going on errands, you've got a bag.
Sure.
Like, why? I don't... It doesn't... it just...
I like the way you're thinking about it. You're thinking about this like this will convince people to bicycle.
Bicycling.com seems to think.
No, but McDonald's is thinking of this as this will convince millennials who own a bicycle to come back to McDonald's.
What's up with that McBike thing?
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
They're associating themselves with bicycles and McCafe and coffee and... This is not about the bicycle.
You know, and I have to admit, I'm nearly tempted to go get one of these just to see what it looks like in real life.
That's
so,
how they
like,
get you,
I know,
man.
I know, and I'm not going to give in.
At participating locations only.
Yeah. Are we one of the participating countries?
In 1975, a loose collection of mainly artists, activists, and anarchists who, styling themselves the poetic Velo-Revolutionary tendency pioneered many of the direct action tactics common to modern protest movements.
What I liked about this article, I love reading articles of this theme, by the way, like this whole like people can do this kind of thing, and especially as it pertains to bikes and how it changes a city. But yeah, what I really liked about this article was it reminded me a lot of the whole critical mass movement around here.
Yeah.
And just how, it started off as like just people in the streets, and it got a lot of creative people out and a lot of people thinking creatively about it. And then it changed the way the city worked and the way the city worked around bicycling.
Yeah, it's incredibly refreshing to remember that sort of bottom-up action can have an effect on that sort of scale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I think has anybody heard of, there's something going on this Wednesday.
There is a day-long, a day of protest at City Hall.
Right.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And I know that starting at 8 a.m., there's a rally out in City Hall for Safer Streets outside of City Hall, and there's going to be some testimony there in the morning. And then there are a couple other events during the day, and then there's another bicycle-related event going on at 4:30, meeting at the... Northwest Park and Cooch, and it's going to be the downgrade Portland ride. And some people I know.
Yeah.
I actually did not plan this.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I didn't. Somebody else planned it.
Like,
I'm going to go on it.
Such a vocal component.
Both of them are being put on by Cloud PDX.
Okay.
I'm just a guy with some internet and beer in a room here, but they actually are advocates time and, you know, like they organize things and are getting something going. So there's been a lot of people working hard on these events that weren't me.
Okay.
But I have heard about them and they are going on this Wednesday. Mm. Yeah. Day
awesome.
Of action.
Yeah, so those of you in Portland who are catching this again, like early enough, definitely the downgrade Portland. We've talked about this actually a couple times when we've talked about Pedalpalooza and that ride in specific as it pertains to kind of shaking up City Hall in a way and how it relates to the bicycle infrastructure here and just saying like we can't sit on our laurels anymore. We might have been like the nation's greatest bicycle city for a while, but we certainly aren't anymore.
Mm. Yeah, and have some work to do. Yeah.
Can I interject as
Please.
In a really serious? So I'm just visiting, and one of the first things I wanted to see when I came to Portland, and this is going to sound terrible, I wanted to see the site of the Burnside Bridge accident. And
And
I am appalled. I just visibly seeing that's three lanes and a bicycle lane and
a giant curb,
a really perpendicular curb,
yeah,
and a really wide sidewalk. That's terrifying to think that we are all, no matter if we're on a bike or we're walking or even in a car, that we are one instant away from that kind of injury or death on the road. Is it's truth, but we don't often think about it.
No, a lot of people don't like to confront that, especially in Portland. We have it, you know, there's spots like that pockmarked all over the inner city. I mean, this is not some remote road. This is in the heart of downtown.
Well, and that was one out of what? Three pretty major accidents, like all happening in the span of a month.
Yeah. Others involving people bicycling. And then there's also been other vehicles that have left the roadway on other bridges and crashed into sidewalks. And they're just
vehicles that have flipped in 25 mile an hour zones.
Yes. Yeah. You've been reading a little bit about Portland.
So here's my, this stuff is, you know, the whole world is watching. The internet exists.
Yeah.
And it's not just Portland, but New York City is also paying a great deal of attention to, and this is my question, I don't know the answer to it, are we just connecting the dots now? Have these sorts of deaths always happened and we haven't thought about them as chains of events? But now, you know, in New York City, when we see another pedestrian crosswalk death, we are just sort of adding it to the toll.
Well, traffic deaths have been near the top of the CDC's list of preventable deaths for like decades, I think. I mean, it's, you know, never, it's the number one cause for, I think, people under 30 now. Yeah. But it's been that way for quite a long time. And it has gotten better somewhat, right? Like, we didn't used to have seat belts and, you know, so things were a lot worse. So, but it has improved, but yeah, it's still pretty bad.
Well, I think especially in the more recent past, we've got the Vision Zero sort of proposals that have been going on in various cities.
Yeah.
And I think that's done a lot, if for nothing else, at least bringing our attention to the fact that our streets aren't really as safe as we
like. Yeah. First step to recovery is admitting you have a problem.
There's the concept that they're not, that these deaths are not inevitable.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, this is a human-built system that we control every aspect of.
And the further idea, and this is getting a lot of pushback from traffic engineers, this is a human-built system, and therefore there is responsibility that humans have designed this, and therefore when these things happen, they are not mere accidents. They are results of a system.
Yeah, system failure.
Yeah. Well, and it's so funny, too, because, you know, the same people traveling through one intersection will be driving dangerously, but then when they're on a neighborhood street, they're driving more safely, and it's the same person, just a different street. And so the behavior changes with the street, not necessarily the person. And so I don't know why people, I mean, that's evident in my own behavior when I see myself drive. You know, I'm a lot more cautious when I'm in my own neighborhood than when I'm going over the Markham Bridge.
Even when I ride, like, my behavior of how I ride changes with where I'm riding.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm certainly more prone to be aggressive on busier streets.
Yeah.
I'm prone to be aggressive in my own town, that when I'm in someone else's town, much more likely to pull my bike over the side and walk it through an intersection, which I'm never going to do at home.
All right. I'm going to do this last one real quick. We're pretty out of time already, but this is a very inspiring story, and I really...
let's end on a high note.
What's that?
Let's end on a high note.
Yeah, good point. Unifying Bike Advocacy, the National Brotherhood of Cyclists Conference. It starts with a quote, "We are the threshold of a movement that really could change the world," said Anthony Taylor, speaking of the recent groundswell of bicycle participation in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and across the U.S. While impressive, the surge in everyday cycling still is yet to reach a 10% modal share in any city. Taylor, vice president of the National Brotherhood of Cyclists and a prominent advocate in the African-American cycling community, views this low share as a positive. To Taylor, it's a blank slate. He looks at Detroit, Michigan with an air of optimism for the future of American cities. While optimism wouldn't be the first word to jump to mind when many people think of Detroit, Taylor argues that, in some measure, Detroit was offered a blank slate. When the manufacturing industry collapsed and took with it many of the city's residences, what remained was a city built for 2 million people that is now home to abandoned buildings and empty streets. Quote, "What happened when a city loses its people? It loses its cars," Taylor explained. "So what happens when people reimagine the possibilities when they've lost their cars? All of a sudden you wind up with biking."
That's really exciting.
Yeah. And it almost makes me feel good to like be from there in a way. And I usually don't brag about that.
Yeah. I actually have been thinking for a couple of years now, I would really enjoy visiting Detroit and just riding around, because I've seen so many positive things about the experience of getting around there on a bike.
This article, I didn't cover it in this blurb here, but this article actually mentions the slow ride in Detroit.
Yeah.
And it's something that you can just go to YouTube and like look up Slow Ride Detroit, and there's just some really cool videos. It's a really cool movement.
Wasn't that guy featured in an iPad commercial?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. Huh. The guy that organizes Slow Ride, it has him like organizing stuff on his iPad to really hit music.
Also, Chicago has a slow roll movement as well.
Right. Oh, cool. That's really awesome.
And, you know, it's Detroit, very wide roads, very little cars on them.
Yeah.
All right.
Blank slate indeed.
Well, I've been having a lot of computer issues here, so we better end this quick. You still have your ability to read? So here's what I've done, and I'm going to see if we can do this. So, Will, if you want to read the red.
Okay. Is that Georgie?
Yes.
Okay.
I will read the unbolded. Lisa, can you read the bolded?
Yep.
All right.
Oh, I'm doing, sorry. I wasn't listening. I'm doing bolded.
You're doing, yes.
Got
you're
it.
Doing the bolded. And I've, we'll see if we can do this before the drum break. I've actually lengthened.
Is it
the,
longer now? Because they're a lot more.
yes, I've actually lengthened.
From
the
a year
song.
Ago, they're a lot more donors.
If you're
now.
Timing this, I'm just going to say everyone should visit bikebattles.net.
yes, and, please.
Yeah. 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 I'm also I'm on Twitter yes. at bikebattlesbook.
Thank you for Bike putting that in there.
Our website is thesprocketpodcast.com.
Email to thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com.
Call or text to 503-847-9774.
Twitter at thesprocketpodcast.
Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music.
Hurt Bird for our headline sounder.
Marcus Norman for graphic design.
And thanks to our sustaining donors, Logan Smith, Johnny K. Shadowfoot,
Katrina Mellengard, Wayne Norman, Doug McBike Robertson,
Ethan Georgie, Justin Martin, Eric Iverson,
Cameron Lee, Richard Wodzinski, Tim Mooney,
Orange and Purple, Glenn Kubisch, Matt Kelly,
Jim Gooden, Eric Wisen, Doug Cohen Miller,
Todd Parker, Scott McAllister Morgan, Chris Gonzalez,
Dan Gebhardt, Zoe Campagna, John Blood,
Allison Wiley, Andy Brunner, Dave Knows,
Lars V, Chris Smith, Christy Kaster,
Caleb Jenkinson, J.P. Cooley, Peanut Butter Jar Matt,
Patrick R. Chain, Gabriel Trainer, Sebastian Poole,
Marco Lowe, Rich Otterstrom, Andrew Alderson,
Drew the Welder, Anna, Christus Gukas,
John Wasserman and Andrew Johnson, brush your teeth and go to bed.
That's it, everybody.